Current state on 90.5 WKAR for Tuesday, the 18th of the month. I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up on the program today, a story about a development in Detroit that would appear to be full of promise. You may be aware of the proposal for the largest urban farm in the world in Detroit. This actually goes back a number of years. Mike Score is the president of Hance Farms, and we are going to talk with Mike Score about where that project stands. It would appear to be moving forward, we're pleased to report. We'll find out more later this hour. Also, we have an important discussion to have with a couple of very special guests regarding the proposal to expand the Education Achievement Authority here in Michigan. We will talk with the Chancellor of Michigan's EAA, John Covington, along with a sponsor of one measure to expand the EAA, State Representative Lisa Postumus-Lyons. She chairs the House Education Committee and the House Ethics and Elections Committee as well. Both of those special guests coming up later this hour. Of course, they came under some fire yesterday from guests that we had on, and we will ask them about those criticisms and the road ahead coming up later in this hour. But first, this winter has been brutal for all of us. The extra snow, cold, and ice that we've been having this season has taken an especially rough toll on those who are living on low and fixed incomes. Our next guest says that the number of people requesting assistance with their utility bills is way up this year, and that the rise in need has been exacerbated by some recent measures enacted by the state legislature. Dr. Joan Jackson Johnson is the director of the Human Relations and Community Service Department for the city of Lansing, and she's here to tell us more. Welcome back to the program, Joan.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. This has been a brutal winter. What are you seeing out there in terms of the need for energy assistance?
Well, the need has just really been unreal. The sad part is that people have no place to go. The enactment of Public Act 615, which denied normal support services for people in October of each fiscal year, was changed, and that start date was November 1 rather than October 1, which meant that people who suffered from utility shutoffs through the summer would not be protected under the winter protection plan that generally operates from November 1 through March 31st. So we had a lot of people starting out this new year without power. And there was no way to really get those resources because the state's Public Act 615 says that the emergency time period would not start until a later date. Unfortunately, we have families with children, we've had seniors who have been seeking assistance, and things right now are compound, one, because of the extended weather. I mean, this is the worst winter I've seen, where we really haven't had a break for a long time. And then the rising cost with fuel, which really makes the bad situation worse. The Department of Human Services has limited resources, and their definition of emergency tends to vary with workers. But also the resources that we count on from the faith-based community, Capital Area Community Services, Salvation Army, even the city of Lansing through St. Vincent's at the Pope, just aren't there.
And Joan, I'm going to have to interrupt you here. We're enduring a really poor connection here.
Okay.
What we'd like to do is to try to get back to you later in the hour on a better connection, so our listeners can understand a little bit more clearly what you're saying. So bear with us. Our producer Joe Lindstroth will be back in touch with you. Hopefully, we can reconnect.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, thank you. We do want to talk about that because that is. That is an important issue here, given the challenges of the season. You're listening to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. While many look at the Super Bowl as the pinnacle of the advertising season, for some companies, Another sporting event is a larger investment, and Current State's Emmanuel Berry joins me in the studio to explain what's going on.
Hi, Mark. Well, the Super Bowl is big for advertisers, as we all know, but the Olympics are also a coveted time for companies. To learn more about Olympic ads, I spoke with Rajiv Batra. He's a professor of marketing at the University of Michigan and an expert in global branding and advertising. He started our conversation by explaining what an Olympic sponsorship is.
Usually what that means is that that company has paid the International Olympic Committee a very large sum of money, which could be something like $40 to $50 million. And that's a combination, I believe, of cash as well as supplies. So for when I say supplies, for example, you may have a watch-keeping company like Omega become the official timekeeper of the Olympics and set up all the timing devices and so on. So it's a combination of money and supplies. And in return for that, they become one of the very small number of what the Olympics calls the TOP list, which is, I believe, 15 to 20 global companies that are these top Olympic sponsors. And they get the rights then to use that sponsorship in their advertising, their packaging, their events, their client relationships, et cetera.
So there are a lot of long-standing Olympic sponsors that I come to mind, like Coke, Visa, McDonald's. Are there any newer corporations that have taken on this position?
Yes, there's been some turnover in terms of electronics companies from Asia. IBM at one time used to be a sponsor for many years, and then I think they concluded they weren't getting their money's worth, so they stepped out. And then Lenovo from China became a sponsor, and then they stepped out, and then Acer became a sponsor, and I don't think they are back now. So there's been some turnover in that slot, but, you know, companies like Coca-Cola and GE and McDonald's and so on and Visa have been sponsors for a very long time. So there's a little turnover now and then, but for the most part, you have a tremendous amount of stability there.
What does it mean for these brands to be able to say, I'm an Olympic sponsor? I mean, what's that branding benefit like for them, relaying their message to consumers?
In the case of some, a very few of these brands, such as Acer, for example, or Lenovo, there may be some awareness building benefit, but that's not true of most of them because most of them are already well-known companies. The way they gain is mostly by associating their brands with the values that the Olympics are known for. Obviously, with the Olympics, there is competitive excellence, but there's also a lot of humanity, human emotions. There's friendship, there's grace, there's respect. You might even call it sort of sentimentality, if you wish. And so brands that are connected with the Olympics benefit by association with those human values. The other aspect of the benefit is the global leadership perception. By being one of the handful of 10, 20 brands that are featured with the Olympics, these brands become seen as global leaders. They gain in stature. And I think that's a major benefit that they get.
You mentioned earlier the price that these companies pay to be sponsors. How does that compare, say, to the price for a Super Bowl spot?
Well, this year, a Super Bowl spot ran for about $4 million for 30 seconds. The Olympic sponsorship, I mentioned the figure of $40 to $50 million, but that actually understates it massively because beyond the $40 or $50 they give the Olympics, these companies typically end up spending another $100 million, $150 million in terms of the advertising and the packaging and the events that leverage that sponsorship. So you're talking about a total of, let's say, $150 to $200 million. The gains are very different as well. So with the Super Bowl, it's a United States limited event. You reach 108 million this year, million people. You reach them once, you know, with a 30-second spot. Plus, of course, there's the viral conversation about the ads that they run and so on. With the Olympics, it's something that's clearly global. It's seen in 200 countries around the world. There's an audience of, I think, believe roughly 5 billion people. There's tremendous repetition and frequency because people, you know, tune into the Olympics events for over 2 weeks. So the scale is very different. And I guess those would be the differences.
Compare a little bit about what a Super Bowl ad is like compared to, say, an Olympic ad.
Well, the Super Bowl is, in fact, research has been done on this, comparing the Olympics and the Super Bowl in terms of the associations that people have with them and the values they symbolize and so on. So, for example, there's a company in New York called BAV Consulting, and they did a research report on this recently. And the Super Bowl is more fun, more approachable, more edgy, more dynamic, more energetic in some ways, while the Olympics are more about being down to earth, socially responsible, authentic, original, etc. So the kinds of imagery that these two events give the brands that get connected with them is sort of different. And so if you want to use analogies, I think a lot of people would agree that Coca-Cola, which has been an Olympic sponsor for a very long time, is more a brand that fits the Olympic spirit, while arguably a brand like Pepsi, which is more youthful, irreverent, and so on, fits the Super Bowl. So I think there's a difference in the character of the two events, not just their scale and the expense involved.
Beyond just the marketing in the sense of the commercials that we're seeing, there's also, you know, you get to feature those Olympic rings on your product. What's the value of that?
Well, that's a way of symbolizing and communicating your Olympic sponsorship on your packaging and in various pieces of collateral and your advertising. So it's a communication device, really. Plus, of course, in terms of the equities, if you will, the things that people connect with the Olympics, the Olympic rings are a very important symbol of the Olympics, along with the torch, the flame. So it's a shorthand way to communicate the unity, the uniting nature of what the Olympics are all about. That's what the rings are all about. And I think that's the idea I mentioned earlier of the Olympics being about shared humanity. And so this notion of uniting all of us all across the world, that's a kind of idea that is very relevant to a brand like Coca-Cola, a brand like McDonald's, a brand like even Visa, or a brand like P&G today, which talks about how it helps the moms of the athletes.
Do companies actually get kind of what they pay for? I mean, is that exposure and this association worth it for them?
That's hard to say. I think with any type of sports sponsorships in general, it's very hard to document the actual return on the incredible investment that companies make. There are some efforts to scientifically assess whether people's attitudes towards brands get improved and raised and whether more people end up buying the brands more often. But honestly, it's an imperfect art. And while I'm sure these sponsors do their studies and do try to calculate ROIs, at the end of the day, a lot of this is gut feel and judgment about what's good for the brand.
Have the advertisements changed that much over the years? I mean, some of these companies have been doing these ads for what seems like decades now. Are there any surprises?
No, I don't really see a lot of surprises. Unlike the Super Bowl, where controversy and originality are very important because people watch the Super Bowl in part for the ads themselves, that's not true of the Olympics. And the Olympics are about, you know, being classic and authentic and original and so on. And so it's a long-term kind of thing. And so I don't see the Olympics being the kind of event where you want to show how different and edgy and controversial you are. So stability is the norm. The ads don't change all that much. Obviously, the creative changes, the people in them change. You need to keep them fresh. But the ideas themselves, I don't think they change a lot.
Rajiv Batra is a professor of marketing and director of the Yaffe Center for Persuasive Communication at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for your time.
You're most welcome.
For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
Tune to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. You can reach us via email at currentstate at WKAR.org, always eager to hear what's on your mind regarding our program. After years of delays, Detroit's Hants Farm is starting to take shape. In 2009, John Hants, CEO of Southfield-based Hants Group, LLC, proposed building the world's largest urban farm in Detroit. After cutting through red tape and shifting plans to focus on building an urban tree farm, the project is starting to unfold. Here to tell us more about the project's next steps, Mike Score, president of Hants Woodlands. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well, and I'm glad to have you on our program here. I've been aware of this effort for I think just about from the very beginning, and it is so interesting. It's been 5 long years since this project was proposed. Briefly, just tell us where it stands today.
Our development agreement with the city was approved in December of 2012, and then following that vote by city council, we went through a due diligence process to fully understand the land that we were purchasing. That process was completed in early 2013, and we signed our development agreement in mid-2013. Then that agreement had to be approved by the state and by the emergency manager's office, and that took us into November of 2013. At that point, we worked with the city to prepare deeds for the property, and in January 2014, we were able to exchange a check for 1,350 parcels, and we now own and manage just over 150 acres in the city of Detroit.
Explain the spaces for our listeners. This is as I understand it, this is not one large space. This is actually a number of spaces.
Yeah, the easiest way to understand the lay of the land is to look at a map, and our properties are located between Van Dyke, St. Jean, Jefferson, and Mack. So it's just over a square mile, and it borders Indian Village and West Village on the city's Lower East Side. So we purchased the vacant and neglected city-owned property within that roughly one square mile. And it's property that surrounds remnant neighborhoods that are still viable. And our investment will make those communities a better place to live.
But is the 150-plus acres, is it contiguous? Is it all one plot of land?
No, it's not. It's bits and pieces of landscape within the square mile. So there'll be, going down the street, there'll be a few houses and then some vacant land and more houses and more vacant land. It's a checkerboard pattern. We own about one-third, one-fourth of the landscape, and the rest is privately owned, and it's a mix of either single homes in the middle of an empty area or combinations of homes that still make up neighborhoods.
Tell us about the bigger challenges trying to put together such a large farm into this space.
I hope most of the biggest challenges are behind us, but when we first started out, John's proposal was really bold and innovative, to go to city leaders and suggest that farm could be used as a tool for reshaping city's landscape, and actually the investment could be made in a way that prepares Detroit to be a future city as opposed to a city in decline. Using a farm as a tool to make neighborhoods more livable was really a progressive vision that John had, but the city was going through a lot of transitions at the time. Its population was declining, its budget was in difficulty, and then there were some political turmoil as well. So asking the city to consider something as innovative as a farm within the urban landscape, it was a big challenge to get to present the idea in a way that the city could really understand, and to get city leaders to turn from those more pressing issues to consider our proposal.
Mm-hmm. What's communication been like with those who live near this project?
We have very strong support from people who live within the area where we're making our investment. Initially, when we agreed with the city that we would focus our investment on the Lower East Side of the city, we went door to door and met with neighbors and they like the idea of our investment making the neighborhoods a better place to live. We had to change our plans so that our investment fit well with the needs and interests of the community residents. But since we began going door to door, and now that we've begun cleaning up vacant lots, picking up garbage, removing brush, our neighbors affirm our work every day that we're out working. And they stop, they tell us that they appreciate our investment, and we try to do our work in a way that fits well with the neighbors.
Initially, your plan was to grow produce on the farm. Now we're just talking about a tree farm. Why did you have to let that go?
Well, when we didn't have a specific location in mind, but it was just a concept, we pictured a U-pick orchard, a U-cut Christmas tree farm, and other types of agriculture that create more jobs, that create a platform for tourism and education. And those are great ideas if you're just thinking about business concepts. But when we went door to door and met with the neighbors, they had two major concerns. One was the idea of producing food in their neighborhood. They worried that produce that fell on the ground would aggravate problems with rodents. And so they asked us not to produce food. They also asked us to stay away from crops that require the use of pesticides. And whether it be organic or conventional, if you're producing high-value products like apples and Christmas trees, when you have pests that threaten the quality of the production, you do have to control the pests if you want to make money. So they asked us to stay away from food crops, from pesticides, and that led us toward hardwood, which is an exciting and viable opportunity for Michigan agriculture.
We're talking with Mike Score, president of Hance Woodlands, what will become a large urban tree farm in the city of Detroit. How will you generate profit, Mike? I mean, how you just wrote a check for $410,000. How are you going to recoup your investment?
Well, we have a parent company. It's a financial service company, and it wasn't an intended outcome, but the criticism of our investment in Hance Farms or Hance Woodlands drew a lot of attention in the marketplace. And we were a cover story in Fortune magazine and a front page story in the Wall Street Journal. And one of the most common reasons for people walking through the door of Hance Financial Services to explore those services and to sign up as customers is that people heard about the farm. So we recovered a fair amount of the overhead costs just from the windfall of succeeding in launching this venture. So now going forward, we just have to recover our costs over time. And in Michigan, timber production and woodlot management is a viable type of agricultural business, and we should be able to get a 5 to 10% return on our investment over time. It just takes a lot of time and a lot of patience to get there.
But how are you generating profit? Are you selling these trees then, or harvesting the wood, or what?
Well, there are a lot of opportunities. We can, for example, we could run a nursery business, and as we put trees in the ground, either early on when they're saplings or as they grow bigger, we can dig out some of the trees and sell them to landscapers and companies that handle ornamental plants. So that's one opportunity. We can also tap silver maples and sugar maples that will be on our property, and we could make maple syrup, which isn't particularly profitable, but maple syrup festivals can be. And if you put something like that in a large urban center like Detroit, I think there is some potential for revenue from tourism. And then over time, we will manage the trees as a timber stand, and in 40 to 60 years, we'll be able to harvest trees and recover our costs at that time.
Amazing to visualize that landscape. Mike, when you worked here at Michigan State, you focused on the tension between urban and rural communities and the role urban agriculture could play in bridging that divide. Are you confident this project will help build stronger relationships like those?
Yeah, I still see that as an important part of this investment. Detroit might sometimes best be described by the fractured relationships that we've seen over time, and part of the fracture is the division of urban and rural communities within our landscape. And when you take something as traditional as a farm, which is normally located out in a rural area, and you put it in a city, you now have new opportunities for urban and rural people within the state to understand each other and to exchange ideas.
Fascinating development here, and we plan to keep an eye on it here, and we wish you the best. Mike Skor, president of Hants Woodlands, a soon-to-be-growing urban forest in Detroit. Mike Skor, good luck and thank you.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan legislators could vote this week on a controversial proposal that would expand the state's Education Achievement Authority. That's the state-run district comprised of 15 of the most challenged schools in the state, currently all in Detroit. EAA administrators, Governor Rick Snyder, and other supporters say the initiative, now in its second year, is beginning to turn around those schools. They say test scores are rising due to a student-centric teaching model, a longer school year, and grouping students by ability instead of age. But opponents of the measure, two of whom appeared on yesterday's program, paint a starkly different picture. They say the EAA is off to a bad start, that it's not serving students, and has serious problems with transparency and demonstrating progress. Well, Current State welcomes two guests who are at the heart of the issue. Both support expansion. First, we welcome the Chancellor of Michigan's Education Achievement Authority, Dr. John Covington. Welcome, sir.
Good morning, and thank you.
Sure. It's our pleasure to have you. And we welcome back to the program the Chair of the House Education Committee, Republican Representative Lisa Postumus-Lyons.
Good morning, Mark.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you as well. Thanks for having me today.
Lisa, let's start with you. Why do you support the expansion of the EAA from 15 schools up to as many as 60?
Sure. The question is, we have, you know, what are we going to do with kids who are trapped in persistently failing schools? The traditional public schools that are currently failing right now have demonstrated that they are leaving kids behind, and I just believe it is too important to these kids and their prospective education to not do something different. And the EAA has proven that they have the ability to turn student achievement around, and I think that is exactly what we need to do for all of our kids stuck in failing schools.
Chancellor Covington, what would you add to that? Why do you feel the district ought to be expanded?
Well, the entire purpose of the Education Achievement Authority of Michigan is to address the persistently lowest achieving schools across the state of Michigan. As you've already indicated to your listening audience, we started with the first 15 schools in the city of Detroit. And while we certainly have critics out there who say that we're not successful, one only has to look at the data to see that our students and our teachers, they've done a remarkable job in a very, very short period of time. We ended the last school year with approximately 68% of our students in achieving 1.5 to 2 years growth in a year, and 64% of those children achieving 1.5 to 2 years growth in the area of mathematics. Our whole intent is to make sure that children are making measurably, statistically significant increases in their academic performance from where they started at the beginning of the year to where they end up at the end of the year. And if we don't do something to ensure that we are positively impacting the education of the lives of our children, it's certainly going to have a serious, or continue to have a serious economic drain on the state's economy, and it's going to do little to help children acquire the skill sets that they need to transform their lives and then be able to contribute back to their communities in which they live.
Now, as you're both aware, and as you've alluded to, there is significant doubt about the progress that you claim EAA schools are enjoying. For one, critics allege a serious lack of transparency. Lisa Lyons, here is how your Democratic colleague on the House Education Committee, Brandon Dillon, put it yesterday here on Current State.
It has been like pulling teeth, to say the least, to get any information out of the EAA. The information we do get is usually from teachers, students, and parents who are unwilling to, in most cases, put their name out there for fear of retribution.
A pretty scathing assessment. What do you make of that?
That's a good question. I appreciate the opportunity to respond to that. You know, for any time you go into a school, you will find teachers or parents or students that aren't satisfied with what is going on. That's just the nature of how humans operate. And for every person you find that has concerns with the EAA, you'll have students and teachers and parents who totally believe in this transformation they're seeing in their kids. We had several of them up just last week to talk to lawmakers as to how the EAA has changed their lives, how these kids are now finally starting to learn. So I take that with a grain of salt to begin with. As far as the transparency, I can assure you, and I've made it, you know, a priority, at least for the House and for our purposes in creating the law. The EAA is, as a public school, will be subject to every single Open Meetings Act and FOIA provisions that any other public school would be. So whatever they're referring to is obviously something beyond FOIA and open meetings.
Chancellor Covington, let's talk about this FOIA situation here. If Representative Ellen Kogan Lipton is to be believed, the EAA clearly resisted requests for important data. When you finally agreed, she alleges a data dump. In other words, so much data that it took weeks and months to sort through all of it. Why has it been so hard, according to Representative Kogan Lipton, to get the information that's been asked for?
Well, first of all, the amount of information that Representative Lipton requested was really a large amount, and so when we finally were able to get the data together, we provided it to her, and that's what she received. The Education Achievement Authority has no problem with transparency. We'll provide anybody anytime that they request the information that they receive. Now, you indicate that there are those who are questioning the results that we claim our children and our teachers received last year. Well, one only has to look at, for example, if you're not taking our word, then we had an outside agency, Excellent Schools Detroit, who evaluated 124 schools across the city of Detroit, which included DPS, the Archdiocese, and charter schools, based on growth. And at the end of the year, when they issued their report card to the general public, all of our six direct-run schools ranked in the top 20 of 124 schools evaluated based on growth. Three scored in the top six, and one ranked in the top three. And so that's not our evaluation. That's an outside agency, Excellent Schools Detroit, looking at the data and evaluating our progress, and not just our progress, but the progress of all schools in the city of Detroit, including the Archdiocese, charter schools, and Detroit Public Schools.
Chancellor Covington, I'd like to ask you about the EAA's per student spending here. The authority gets state money. It gets some federal dollars, at least $10 million from the Broad Foundation, plus contributions from other foundations. How much does the EAA spend on each of its students? What's its per pupil cost all in?
I would say that our per pupil expenditure for students is probably about $6,100 minus the debt service. Well, no, about $7,100, including the debt service that we pay to Detroit Public Schools for occupying their schools. When you look at removing that portion of our per pupil allocation that we get for paying debt service to Detroit, we're probably expending about $6,200 per kid, and that's after startup revenue that we receive from philanthropic groups within the state of Michigan and also including the Broad Foundation.
So this, in your view, are you concerned at all about the sustainability of paying for the EAA?
No, not at all. Once we launch or onboard a school, Mark, we live within the per pupil allocation that we get from the state, as well as the federal contribution that we get from the government. And so, in essence, we're spending after a school is onboarded and we get the school started. The amount of revenue that we receive is a little less than what a normal school district would receive, because we don't receive local taxes. We only receive the federal dollars and the state dollars.
Lisa, update us on where the measure is. It was in committee. Has it moved out of committee now?
4369 moved out of the House Education Committee back in March of 2013, and moved off the floor at that same month. So it was spent several months in 2013 over in the Senate, where they deliberated, discussed, made changes to the bill, and voted it out in December. And now the bill is back before the House for concurrence. And we continue to discuss, based on changes that the Senate made, what the House wants to see as part of that EAA bill prior to taking a vote on it. So it's back in the House floor.
But it's on the floor or in your committee?
It's on the floor. It passed out of our committee last year in 2013.
Now, you've been blasted here for skipping hearings on this, and there is some degree of hesitation even from your fellow Republicans on this. Why not? Why did you skip the hearings? Why wasn't this more thoroughly discussed?
I guess my question would be, on what basis are people saying I've skipped hearings? I'm the chair of the Education Committee. It's my bill. I preside over the committee. I've never skipped an education hearing.
Critics point to a 24% drop in enrollment between the first year and this school year. John Covington, if the district is off to as good a start as you claim, wouldn't that number have been a lot lower?
Well, not necessarily, when you consider the structure of how we operate in the Education Achievement Authority. For example, our first day of school is September the 4th, and we are not out of school until August the 6th. So we're basically running a year-long calendar. And then when you look at the number of students that what you're hearing is correct. We did drop in enrollment. But when you look at what grade level, traditional grade levels, those students are, they're basically high school students who indicated that they left because our calendar conflict with some of the things that they would like to accomplish during the summer months. For example, if they want to go to Michigan University to participate in Upward Bound, or they get a summer job, or participate in any other number of initiatives at colleges and universities during the summer months. And so what we've done is we will be launching a trimester calendar this summer, so that we can maintain those students and offer them the flexibility and the autonomy to still participate in those kinds of experiences while maintaining their status with the Education Achievement Authority.
I want to play for both of you the comments of one of our guests yesterday. Brooke Harris taught at Mumford High School in Detroit in the EAA's first year, last year. She described a video lesson about a book she claims is typically not taught in middle school that she was told to teach to her 10th graders. She refused. She did not. Here's why.
I thought it was condescending and offensive. I did show that lesson to a group of community members, one of whom was a parent of a student at Mumford, and she found me after that presentation and told me that she cried. When she saw what the EAA thought her student was intellectually capable of, it made her cry. She wept that is what I was supposed to be teaching in my class, but I refused to do.
This gets back to this the buzz system, which we talked about yesterday. What school districts around the country have used the buzz system before?
Buzz is, first of all, it should be understood that buzz is not the primary source of getting
information, knowledge, and or teaching to children. Now, that is the teacher's role. Buzz is nothing more than a tool where a number of resources reside, including open source and proprietary resources that teachers can use to enhance children's education and to help them get to the growth that we're trying to achieve by the end of the school year. So the tool, Buzz, is nothing more than a tool. Right now, I think we're the only primary district in the country that's using the system. There's a number of other districts that are looking at moving to the system. So Buzz is designed primarily to help teachers better facilitate, better teach in a blended, student-centered environment. It is not the most people understand would assume that, okay, teachers, students will go to the Education Achievement Authority and sit in front of computers all day. That is absolutely, positively not our system. So sometimes Buzz is confused as being the curriculum, and it is not. We meet children where they are.
You did teach a novel without the novel, though. That was really the bottom line of some of the comments that were made.
Okay, when you say teach a novel without the novel, I have no idea what your guest on yesterday is talking about. There, when I say that Buzz includes a number of open source and proprietary resources, it includes novels as well. And so, basically, teachers are free. And they have the autonomy and flexibility to use those open resources in a number of ways to get to the children's or to help the children overcome the deficiency that they have in terms of where they are.
As you're seeing, a lot of the criticisms that have been displayed or communicated about the EAA itself and the legislation that we're working on, many of which are frankly just baseless, are really distracting from the issue. The issue is we have children. I have four kids, and two of them are in our public schools, and they are so fortunate to go to a quality school where the community has rallied around the learning and the teachers care, and the students are there. They're thriving. There's just a vitality there. These kids don't have that. And the status quo, what everybody else, the critics are defending, is not working. And it hasn't been working, and it is leaving the kids behind. That's why this is so important. The state has a constitutional obligation to provide an education to all of Michigan's kids, no matter where they live. And I, as chair of education committee, and most of all as a mother, I want to make sure that we are making every effort we can to educate our kids in a quality environment. And anything short of that, frankly, is abdicating our constitutional role, and it's immoral.
Candidly, Chancellor Covington and Representative Lyons, if a fraction of the comments coming from Representative Dillon, from Representative Lipton, are accurate, they would have us believe that it's miraculous that we're having a discussion about expansion at all. I would go so far as to say that the EAA, in its smaller role, in its current role, they would maintain is worthy of a vigorous review.
Yeah, we have found that there's no depths that defenders of the status quo won't go to stop innovation and change. I think as you look at the results, actual learning going on in the EAA for those kids, those results are impressive as they are inspiring, and you can't make those test results up.
And I would also add that any review that we or that they want to have us undergo, we are transparent. We don't have a problem with it. We believe, and we're going to stand by, that every child in the state of Michigan deserves the best possible education that we can give them, including those who are relegated at no fault of their own of attending persistently lowest achieving schools, not only in the city of Detroit, but some in other areas of the state. And these young people have been failed for years. When you look at the the level of their academic progress when we acquired these schools compared to where they are now. Representative Lyons is absolutely correct. The growth that they have made is impressive. But when they were in these failing schools, they were getting failing grades, and in terms of growth, they were failing to make growth year after year after year after year. And not to have a alternative in place where these children can have a fair chance at life hinders on being outright criminal.
Well, I don't think that even your harshest critics would maintain that this isn't a very challenging landscape. I mean, I don't think Representative Lipton or Representative Dillon or Senator Hopgood have maintained anything other than that, just to be perfectly clear. Why not? You've taken more heat here, Lisa, for not waiting until the MEEP scores come out next month. We got a really important measurement of student academic progress coming up next month. Why not wait until those are in and bolster your case with those scores?
I'll let Dr. Covington talk about the MEEP scores, but where I sit, we've waited long enough to help these kids that are in failing schools. I'm not willing to wait any longer. These schools that are on the persistently lowest achieving list have demonstrated over and over and over again what they're doing is not working. I will not wait any longer. I know Dr. Covington may talk a little bit about this, but it's universally accepted that MEEP scores just don't adequately reflect student growth, whether it's from the students in the EAA or where my kids go to school.
Why do we use the MEEP at all?
Good question, Mark. We're not going to be using the MEEP anymore. We're in this transition phase of moving to a new state assessment that everybody understands the importance of measuring student growth. So I expect to see that this next year. With regards to the MEEP scores, though, the scores we get this year won't tell us much because I don't know what the scores will be, but they won't tell us much because it's not the same batch of kids who were the same students who were test on the MEEP last year. Those students are now in fourth grade. We're testing a whole new set of students who came from second grade who are now in third grade. So that won't measure what the students are actually achieving and learning as a result of the EAA education model.
John Covington, another criticism is that many of the students the district serves are special needs and that EAA schools are simply not staffed to address those needs. What do you make of that?
Well, I think and that criticism is somehow suggesting that the Education Achievement Authority cherry pick. We take any child who comes through our doors and provide them with the same opportunity that we would provide any other regular education child. And I think there's been a misunderstanding as to what it is we do in the Education Achievement Authority relative to special education children. For example, the national average of special education is maybe 14% thereabouts. Don't hold me to that, but approximately 14%. When we acquired the first 15 schools, for example, in one of our schools, the special education population was 47-48%. Now, it's not rocket science to know that when you have special education figures that high, that someone has over-identified children for special education services when they shouldn't have been. And so as a result of that, my directive, and I'm going to stand, I stand by this directive, and I do not apologize for it. My directive was to look at every single IEP of every single special education child that we have, review that IEP, and then as a result of that review, determine whether or not that child should have been assigned to special education or assigned for special education services. And so in many cases, what we were looking for, we found that those children never should have been enrolled in special education. And as a result of that, we provided them with a transition plan to take them out. And so for those children who are truly special education and should be receiving special education services, we want them to be provided with the same
opportunity as their regular education peers. But if students were over-identified for whatever the reasons are, we then do whatever we can to make sure that they are placed and taught and be provided with appropriate educational programs and services to meet their diverse and their unique needs, period.
One more funding question before we wrap this up. John Covington, there's a $30 million grant from the Federal Department of Education to allow for an expansion to these 60 schools. Among the 10 school districts included are Grand Rapids and Lansing. The grant says it will impact approximately 46,000 students and more than 2,200 teachers. That's a direct quote. Will the $30 million cover all of that cost?
And I can only assume that when you talk about a grant that we received from the United States Department of Education, that that is a TIF grant and that is for pay for performance. And so that grant, if we're talking about one and the same federal grant, and that's the only grant we receive in that magnitude, so it would have to be that one, is really for teacher salaries, is to pay teachers for increased positive student outcomes.
Okay. We want to thank both of our guests here for joining us today. A very hot topic at the state capitol, the expansion of Michigan's Education Achievement Authority. We want to thank the Republican chair of the House Education Committee, Lisa Postumus Lyons, and Chancellor John Covington of the EAA. Many thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
That's our show for today here on Current State. Coming up tomorrow, we learn more about the Michigan Office for New Americans. Also, we'll discuss the fallout from the Tennessee-based Volkswagen workers voting against joining the United Auto Workers Union. We also hope to hook up with Joan Jackson Johnson here tomorrow about some of the struggles for heating assistance for people living in the city of Lansing. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth's our producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and Hannah Michael John for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.